Welcome to part three of Bob Crew, the Master and the Music. I am now pleased to present a session musician who was on a lot of the Bob Crew recordings, a top-notch guitarist. His name is Ralph Casale. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for asking me to be part of this tribute.
When and where did you first meet Bob Crew?
I met Bob Crew through Frankie Valli and Charles Colello, who asked me to play on a Four Seasons recording date. The song was Dawn. I believe I began working with Charlie Colello, who at the time was Bob Crew's musical arranger, and I continued to work with Bob Crew for a number of years thereafter.
And then you were on a lot of the later records too, right? I Got You Under My Skin?
Yes, Let's Hang On. A lot of Four Seasons. How about Can't Take My Eyes Off You?
Yes, I've heard of that. I could name that tune in two notes. A lot of people play instruments. A lot of people play instruments very well, but I'm sure a lot of those people who play instruments and play instruments very well may not necessarily either want to or be able to be a successful session musician. I assume, first off the bat, you have to be able to read music.
Today, I don't think you do. Years ago, yes, you absolutely had to.
Let's talk about the Four Seasons 1960 time around. You had to, right? That was a requirement back then.
Yes, that was a requirement. But at that time, I would do many other dates. For instance, I used to do TV commercials. I would work with people like Steve Lawrence, Frank Sinatra. And you absolutely had to know how to read and read well. If you were working with Don Costa, they were complicated. And you'd have to be able to read because he arranged quite a bit.
And you had to read the notes exactly as they were on the printed page. For the most part, I'm talking about.
Sometimes, yes. It depends. Many times they would let you improvise if you wanted. Because you know more about a guitar than the arranger. So they would allow you, if they did something that wasn't quite right, you could change it. And they recognized that.
You did the very famous guitar portion in the middle of Lightning Strikes, a number one hit for Lou Christie, your guitar work. And that's just you.
Yes, it's just me. It's a bass guitar with a fuzz box. And at the time, I didn't realize that they were talking about thunder, you know, and that was a thundering sound. So Charlie recognized that right away.
Right.
However, I didn't know the title of the song or the lyrics. So I was just playing around, fooling around, and he heard that, and he says, "Hey, I want to put that in there." I just laughed. "You are kidding," I said. He says, no, play it. So I played it, and that's it. After I heard the song, I said, yeah, now I know why Charlie did that.
Talking about Bob Crew now, I know you have a very interesting story about a certain recording session.
He was really a great guy. If he had a musical problem, he walked through it with ease. And this is an example. One time after a session, he asked me if I could stay a while longer. There were two other guitarists on the date, but they had already gone. Then he asked me to overdub the three guitar parts we just recorded. I thought that was strange because the guitar parts sounded fine. So I overdubbed the parts. I later had to question him as to why. Why was it done? Well, somebody lost the guitar track. Most people would get upset about that. They lost the three guitars. He just seemed to walk right through it, finish the date, and that was it. They were on the session. They got paid.
They got paid. That's okay. But it was actually you playing all the guitar parts because the guitar tracks, what happened to them?
To this day, I don't know what happened. They just disappeared.
When you think of Bob Crew, what's uppermost in your mind?
He was very creative. He never stopped exploring different musical ideas and different kinds of music, whether it was jazz, classical rock, folk, you name it. He loved it all. Sometimes he would incorporate all of them together. There were no boundaries with Bob. What was interesting about Bob was that he described sounds and the feeling he wanted in songs by asking the band to envision parts of nature, the sky, the clouds, the wind, and so on. So he wanted us to get involved with the song and lyric. Isn't that what music is all about, really? But occasionally he would even dance to the track. I guess he wanted to see if the track was danceable. How about using different objects like a Coke bottle or a can to create different sounds? And I do believe that all those that were connected musically with Bob Crew learned quite a bit about the recording techniques of the era.
Next on this very special tribute, we have a singer-songwriter who was and still is a member of the Delicates, legendary DJ Murray the K's Original Dancing Girls. And she's the one who says, yeah, on this little snippet.
Beep, 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 friends of birds. Beep, 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 yeah, beep, beep.
Welcome, Denise Ferry.
Hi, Ronnie.
Hi, Denise. Black and White Thunderbird has become popular in the last few years all over the world. The little song that could came out in 1959, I believe.
That's right.
And the other Delicates were and are
Peggy Santillia and Arlene Lanzotti.
Before we discuss Bob Crew and the records that you recorded for him, we received, especially for this tribute, a comment from Frankie Valli, and I would like to read it right now. The most animated, energizing, and brilliant man has gone. This is the greatest tragedy. We will miss him so much. And Denise, I understand you received something as well.
Yes, I received mail from Bob Gaudio, and he asked me to say the following on his behalf. A man who didn't know how not to be creative. He had an amazing ability to find talent anywhere, anytime. A wonderful artist, singer, dancer, pretty much able to do it all. We had some very successful times in the studio and a few that I'm sure he would prefer not to mention. But all in all, it was the best of times. Losing a close friend and creative partner is something you know is going to happen, but you really don't believe it until it does. I will miss him.
Right now, we're going to talk about the three records that you did with Frankie Valli, produced by Bob Crew. In addition to yourself, who were the backup singers on these records?
Peggy Santillia and Bernadette Carroll.
The first one is You're Ready Now.
You're Ready Now, actually, when it came out in the 60s, it kind of faded away, and then it made a resurgence, and it became a Northern Soul anthem in the past years. And a little unknown fact on that is that Joe Pesci was also doubling Frankie on that recording.
You're ready now, you're ready now, oh, you're ready now. You pick up quick, I knew you would. You move and groove just the way you should. You got that feel.
All right, we're going to go to the next one, which is the Proud One. And eventually, I believe the Proud One was recorded by the Osmonds.
Yes.
But originally by Frankie Valli.
Frankie Valli. That was great. That the background was myself again, Peg and Bernadette. And that we did like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'll never forget that session. That song modulated so high. I can't even imagine that we even sang that high. It's a beautiful recording and great, great harmony.
And finally, you did Cry For Me.
Yes, that song is a beautiful song, and it's featured in Jersey Boys, and I noticed that they did the backup exactly the way we did it back in the day.
I cried for you. I cried for me.
great recording sessions with Frankie Valli. And Denise, that had to be so very special to you.
It was wonderful.
Now, right around the time that you three girls were doing that, you also formed a group.
With Peggy, Bernadette, and myself. And we called it Jessica James and the Outlaws. Peggy was the lead, and she was Jessica James, and Bernadette and I were the Outlaws. And we recorded two wonderful songs. One was Give Her Up, Baby, and the other was We'll Be Making Out. And the interesting part of We'll Be Making Out is, during that same time frame, we were doing Lou Christie work as well. Lou came into the studio, and he sang backup on that with Bernadette and myself. It was a lot of fun to have the three of us in the backup of that record.
We'll hear those two as a little medley right now. Give Her Up, Baby, and We'll Be Making Out.
Give her up, baby. Give her up. Why are you giving her up, baby?
Give Her Up, Baby, We'll Be Making Out. Those were released on Bob Crew's label, Dyna Voice. And who produced them?
Bob Crew and Bob Gaudio. The two Bobs.
They were Bob Bobbing along.
The Bob Bobs.
You were on the final single in the career of the legendary Kitty Callan.
It was called One Grain of Sand. And it was the most beautiful, haunting record. And it was so special to us.
Just like one grain of sand.
Bob Crew is iconic. He left an incredible mark in music history. There'll never be another like him.
And now, I have on the phone a gifted musician and arranger, the man who arranged this great Frankie Valli hit. I know, you can easily name that tune with just those notes. Here's the man who was the lone arranger of that particular recording, Mr. Artie Schreck. Spelled S-C-H-R-O-E-C-K,
but pronounced like the monster.
But much nicer than the monster, right?
Yeah, well, I'm a nicer guy than he was.
Okay. I believe it was in the mid-60s when you and Bob Crew first connected.
I met him 1965. I went up to him because I was playing on a lot of the Four Seasons records when Charlie Colella was arranging for him. Then I went up there to his office, 60th and Broadway, to write a song with him. We wrote a song together called No One Comes to My Door Anymore. I don't think anything ever happened with it, but I used to go up there to get myself going in that end of the music business. And then finally, when Colella went to Columbia Records, he couldn't do any other thing. I ended up
one of the primary arrangers for Bob Crew.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you a question that I asked Charlie Colella. How did you, Artie Schreck, become an arranger?
I was in high school at the time. I got the Swinging Lovers album by Frank Sinatra, and I heard Nelson Riddle's arrangement, and I said, that's what I want to do.
Charlie Colella told me he heard a Sinatra record, I guess it was a different one, and he pulled the arrangement out of that, and he started doing that. So in that respect, you and Charlie do have something in common, that you took the same path. You took a Sinatra thing, and you got inspired to do arranging from that.
And Charlie and I went to high school together. We knew each other since we were freshmen in high school.
What was the first one that you arranged for Bob?
The first one was I Got You Under My Skin.
That's one of Tommy DeVito's favorites.
That's the first one I did, and Bob Crew's genius on that was
the song ended, and that's what we were going to do, end the song.
Yes.
And he said, give me a drum fill and let's go back to Never Win. And Buddy Salzman gave one of the great drum fills of all time, and the rest was history.
The arrangement that you are best known for doing was the legendary recording of Can't Take My Eyes Off You. How did you approach that job? Did Bob Crew tell you what he wanted, or did you start from scratch?
I actually was at Bob Gaudio's house, and we went over the work together on that song. We sketched it out, and basically what they wanted was a Stan Kenton kind of arrangement, and that's how I approached it, almost like a jazz record, except with a rock beat.
How many instruments were on that recording, do you remember? And what were they?
There were three trumpets, a French horn, a trombone, and two saxes. And then, of course, the rhythm section, bass player. And the guitar players were Vinnie Bell and, I think, Ralph Casale.
And I recall that there were also strings on that record.
Irving Spice string section. An interesting story. Bob Goody and I didn't want strings on that particular session. We only wanted it when the I love you, baby. Love you,
yeah.
Babe. We had one note for the strings to play at that place, and all of a sudden Bob Crew said, I want strings on the second verse. And we said, well, we don't have them. He says, well, give me some strings. So on the wall of Mirror Sound, I think we did it at Mirror Sound.
Right.
On the wall of Mirror Sound, I literally wrote the string part out. I said, give me a piece of music paper, I'll write a string line for you.
Just like you improvised it quickly.
Yes. And I wrote the string line, they made copies of it, and they gave it out to the string players, and that was the string part on that record.
Well, here's the beginning of that record. And this is where you hear those beautiful strings.
We love you, you're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. As long as love has won, and I thank God I'm alone. You're just too good to be true.
What an incredible arrangement. Was Bob Crew himself ever an arranger, per se?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't an orchestrator, but sometimes he did his own arrangements. He sang the parts to the guys, and they played them. He didn't write anything out.
Bob Crew told me he used to sometimes, occasionally, go to the manuscripts that the arrangers did. He would draw thunder, meaning this has got to be louder. That's what he told me.
A lot of times it was thunder.
Thunder.
The soundtrack of thunder. He said, I hear clouds here.
But he'd actually write it on the manuscript.
Yeah.
When you think of Bob Crew, how will you remember him?
As a crazy genius producer. He would do crazy things on record dates. He would hear a sound in the recording studio and say, I want that on the record. The guitar player would be fooling around with something, and he'd say, I want that on the record.
Even though the guitar player was probably tuning his guitar.
Yeah, something like that. That's why I call him a crazy genius.
Our next guest is a gifted songwriter who's actually gone under a couple of different names. He was known at one point as Larry Brown, and now he's known as L. Russell Brown. Now, should I call you Larry or L?
You can call me Larry.
How did L. Russell Brown come about?
Well, when I was a boy around 5 years old, my mother called me Lawrence. And I said, you know, I just don't like the name Lawrence. I don't like how it sounds. It sounds like my cousin Florence. She said, would you like us to call you Larry? I said, I like Larry more, and then from 5 years on, I became Larry, And when I met Bob Crewe, I was Larry Brown. And Bob Crewe, when I walked into his office, the first time his brother Dan introduced me to him, I looked at him, and he looked like Robert Redford's better-looking brother. our eyes locked in, and we smiled at each other and shook hands, and there was an electric feeling there. And I looked up at the wall, and I said, how does anybody ever get a wall full of gold records, or any one gold record? And Bob Crewe said to me, Larry, I promise you, you're going to have as many gold records as that on that wall, and greater one.
Wow.
And he says, I'm going to send you over to BMI, and I want you to meet the vice president, Thea Zabin, and she's going to sign you to BMI. They're going to give you an advance, and we're going to match it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and I said, Bob Crewe sent me, and she loved Bob Crewe. She looked at her Rolodex. We have a Larry Brown. We have a Lawrence Brown. She said, what's your middle name? I said, Russell. She said, well, would you mind if we call you L. period Russell Brown for logging purposes so we don't confuse your music with others? I said, no, I have no problem with it. And she looked at me, and God bless her soul, she said, I see a future in that name. I met her just before she died, and she said to me, as I left her office, she had a cigarette in each hand, and she was 82. She yelled out, she said, Larry, if you know anybody that needs a name, send them up. That's how I became L. Russell Brown.
You wrote this song about a yellow ribbon, and you co-wrote that with Irwin Levine?
Oh, yes. I wrote many songs with Irwin, but that was our flagship song.
One tie, yellow ribbon around the old. Forget about us, put the blame on me. If I don't see a yellow ribbon around the old tree.
Sadly, Irwin passed away a few years ago, I believe, right?
Yes, he did. Tragically, at a pretty young age.
Well,
he was an amazing person.
And the two of you also wrote Knock Three Times for Tony and Dawn.
Let me say this about Yellow Ribbon and Knock Three Times. All the hits that I had, I believe in my heart, they probably never would have seen the light of day. Had Bob Crewe not taught me for 3 years brutally, every day he'd criticize the song I wrote, as I was, close to tears. But when it was all over, at the end of 3 years, I wrote Sock It to Me Baby with him. And then 3 months later, Raymond Ludworth and I wrote Mary Ann.
Yes.
These two songs had such an impact on the business that producers like Hank Mender said, I want to hear your songs.
Here's brief samples of those two songs. Sock It to Me Baby by Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, which you wrote with Bob Crewe.
Honey in the beehive, honey bunch. Every time you kiss me, hit me like a bunch. Pretty, 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 oh, I want, yes, I do what you got. Talk it to me, baby, baby. Talk it to me, baby, baby. Gotta stop it.
And here's a little of the Four Seasons. Come on, Mary Ann, composed by you and Raymond Ludworth.
I want to tell you, it is such an honor to be a part of a tribute to the greatest music man I ever knew in my life. He was a friend, a teacher, and a born genius, and he treated me like an equal from the moment I met him. I love Bob, and always will.
We have a recording artist who back in 1963 cried at her party, but that turned out to be a happy party because she started her career with a number one million seller. It's My Party, and then followed it up with Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, Maybe I Know, etc., etc., and so forth. Welcome Leslie Gore.
Thank you, Ronnie. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's been a very blessed bunch of decades for me. It's a wonderful way to live your life by making music and sometimes even making other people happy.
Yes.
And I'm very blessed to have been one of those people who can do that, as is the gentleman we're about to talk about.
He sure was. By the way, you were an Academy Award nominee. It was not an acting role, but it was for a song that I believe you co-wrote with your brother, Michael Gore, Out Here on My Own.
That's correct, yes.
From the motion picture called Fame. Now, yesterday I interviewed Jean Thomas, who said that she did backups for you, and one of them was Maybe I Know.
So. Absolutely. Jeannie Thomas, Mikey Harris, and Ellie Greenwich were kind of my girls' group, and they were amazing. Jeannie Thomas sang on a lot of stuff,
yeah. And
they really helped me create an incredible sound.
Your early hits from 1963 through 1965 were produced by Quincy Jones, and we want to give him credit for what he did for your career.
Absolutely.
They included Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows, which was a song written by Marvin Hamlisch. In 1967, you recorded a very different song, also co-written by Marvin Hamlisch. Actually, the first one, Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows, was exclusively written by Marvin. The one in 1967, co-written by Marvin and Howard Liebling, and it was a song called California Nights, and I'm thinking, this is a girl who grew up in Tenafly, New Jersey, and the first hit single that she has, which mentions a place, it's pretty far removed, California Nights, and this time, you had a different producer. Who was that producer, and how did you meet him?
That would be Bob Crew. About a year before I started working with Bob, Mercury Records, my record sales had started dwindling, and they unceremoniously let me go. And Bob Crew came to me with his brother and said, how would you like to record with us? And I actually signed with Bob, and we did quite a few recordings. In fact, most of what we did was never released, but California Nights, of course, was. I remember that Bob was an extremely extroverted human being, and musically, he was a total force. I do remember my sessions with him. They were always quite incredible, always energetic. Bob would very often wind up standing on the console and dancing as the mixes went down. And the atmosphere in the studio was always very up and very party-like.
Having worked with Quincy Jones for your early hits, would you say that Bob had a very different style? I don't know if Quincy danced around in the studios.
They had a completely different style, but both of them were blessed with an enormous amount of talent. Quincy's musical talent in terms of what was written down or what he could write was more extensive than Bob's, but it didn't mean that Bob couldn't get his ideas across. He may not have been able to write them down on a piece of paper as Quincy was able to do. Of course, he studied arrangement and did arrangements for Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington. But Bob would often come into the studio with simply a song in his head and virtually give everyone parts around the room. So the talent was different, but they were both extraordinary. I worked with probably the two most incredibly talented producers ever.
California Nights, what was your reaction when you first heard the song?
Well, I loved the song. I was a great Marvin fan. I loved the opening. I loved the riff. I knew that Marvin had begun doing some composing and scoring out in Hollywood, and I know that he was very taken with it, and I was taken with the song, and in fact wound up moving out to California myself for a number of years in the 70s.
California night, when I walk
live in a city that still is playing Jersey Boys. So every night, if I really wanted to, I could head down there and at least get a glimpse of Bob Crewe. The one thing I want to say is I'm glad before he left this planet that he knew people loved his work and honored him. I think he experienced that, and I'm so happy. So many people don't get that.
And now I'm going to bring on a man with a couple of identities. His first identity came with this recording.
Not for me, please. Not for me, please. Well, you can take that aside, leave it hanging on the rack and bring the sweater back.
Then he had a different identity on this recording.
And the wheels go oomba, click, clack, click, clack, oomba.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to bring on Jerry Granahan, a.k.a. Dickie Do, and also some of the don'ts.
Hey, Ron, you got me pretty busy.
You were pretty busy.
Yeah.
And that was just as a recording artist, because after that, you were at least four or five different hats beyond that. You heard a little bit of No Chemise, Please. You did that as Jerry Granahan, which is your real name, I believe, right?
Yep, it is.
And then you were the lead singer on the Dickie Do and the Don'ts record of Click Clack.
Right.
You were some of the Don'ts as well, weren't you?
I did mostly all the background. Right.
And by the way, you wrote both of those songs, No Chemise, Please and Click Clack. And then there was this one that you did as a member of the Fireflies.
You were mine at the time, and the feeling was sublime. You were mine, you were mine, you were really, really mine.
Richie Adams was the lead singer, and you were several of the Fireflies. In fact, other than Richie, you were actually all of the male Fireflies' voices in the background?
Yeah.
And what about the girls?
Three little girls were just sitting there watching. It was my secretary's neighbors.
Gosh.
One of them still had her cheerleading outfit on, believe
me. Oh,
it or
wow.
Not.
So those were the Fireflyettes, so to speak.
Yep.
Beyond being a recording artist, you were the founder and owner of Caprice Records.
Right.
And the major artists there were the Angels, Till and Cry Baby Cry, Janie Grant, Triangle, and That Greasy Kid Stuff, and an artist named James Ray.
Right.
If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody. You eventually went to United Artists and became the head A&R man. Among things you did there was producing Jay and the Americans, Cara Mia, and others. So you've done so many different things, and you've told me that you'd like to share your thoughts about Bob Crewe.
Bob and I started just about the same time. I didn't even know who he was. Then all of a sudden I heard these records, and I'm hearing this foot stomping, all the innovations that he came up with.
Oh, yes.
He'd get in the studio, and he'd become like the Frankenstein. You know, he started creating things that were like nobody would think about. And he gave me the incentive to do the same thing. I've done so many crazy things in the studio only because of Bob. I was in the studio. I watched him work a couple times. So impressive watching him work. He took control, and he just smiles through the whole thing. And then there's mixing and editing. And in those days,
yes,
you know, we didn't have a computer to punch a button and change something.
Oh, yeah.
You want to change something, you took a razor blade.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've cut my fingers on some of those, trying to do splicing tape and all
God.
That stuff.
I mean, people don't realize it.
Well, listening to what you've just said, I guess the bottom line about Bob Crewe is that he inspired you.
Very much so.
Right now we have, oh my goodness, I am really excited about this.
Sugar, oh honey, honey, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting.
We have the radio reunion.
reunion of the Archies. I am pleased to welcome three Archies, Archie, Betty, and Veronica. Welcome Ron Dante, Tony Wine, and Tony Wine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ronnie.
I'm just all choked up, as you can tell. I have a question about that record. Not merely a number one hit, but still, 45 years later, people still love that song, people all around the world. Ron, any quick thoughts about Sugar Sugar?
Well, it has to be my most favorite recording session ever. Tony Wine and I were just having a great time singing during those years.
Oh,
spectacular years. And to go in and be able to record a great Jeff Barry, Andy Kinn song was the best thing we could have ever done. But who knew it would be a number one record around the world?
As the Archies, you recorded many other songs as well. Bang Shang Lang was your breakthrough hit. Jingle Jangle and Who's Your Baby and a few others. But Sugar Sugar, far and away the most successful. And I got a question for Tony now. Obviously, you have three primary characters there. You got Archie Andrews and Betty Cooper and Veronica Lodge, and you were Betty and Veronica. Initially, was there any thought to having another backup singer doing one of the voices rather than just having you?
No, Jeff just said, I'm going to make your life so sweet. Do a low voice for Betty and a high voice on Veronica. Was such a fun song. You know, we all wanted to be the Archies, all of us kids reading the comic books. Yeah. It was just a natural, fun, happy-go-lucky record.
It's funny, over the years, some of my friends have said, oh, you had two girls do those voices.
I know, me
and,
too.
And they said, and one was a soul sister.
Right.
One was a sister, right?
Right, yeah. Right. I know.
Ron, you've had an incredible career, and back in the 60s, maybe a lot of people didn't know who you were, because you were kind of anonymous in many respects.
I was enjoying my time as a studio singer.
Yeah.
And we were singing commercials and doing backgrounds and doing anything, demos for other people's songs, and I was used to it. It was fine with me. I didn't have to travel and tour with the records that I made. I could just let the groups go out or let the name go out.
I guess you started out in the business as a detergent. Yep. Leader of the laundromat, you did this immortal line.
Hey, Murray, is it true Betty's wearing your ring?
Oh, man.
That was fabulous.
No, it was really funny. You work hard, and you train, and you study your voice, and you plan for your first big hit record. And what comes along but this crazy novelty record that you don't even sing lead on? You just do backgrounds, and it becomes a top 10 hit.
Hilarious.
Called Leader of the Laundromat. What an inauspicious beginning for a vocal career.
I got a date tonight with the leader of the laundromat.
And eventually, you became all of the cufflinks on this top 10 record.
Tracy, when I'm with you, something you do bounces me off the ceiling. Tracy, day after day, when you're this way, I get a love and
Tony and I learned how to overdub our voices, obviously, as studio singers and doing demos for people. So we're able to, you know, make it sound like they were groups.
Tony, you did something that very, very few people in the history of pop music have done. Not merely writing a number one hit song, but writing a number one hit song that became number one in two different versions. What
very
was that
lucky
song, Tony?
It's called Groovy Kind of Love.
Yeah.
And I wrote it with Carol Bayer. And you're right, it went to number one in 1966 with the Mindbenders, an English group.
Yes.
And then again it went to number one, and we were really lucky. It became BMI's Song of the Year in 1989 with Phil Collins.
Here's a short sample of both versions combined.
When I'm feeling blue, all I have to do is take a look at you.
I'm not so blue. When you're close to me, I can feel your heartbeat. I can hear you breathing in my ear. Wouldn't you agree, baby, you and me got a groovy kind of love.
Tony, you also co-wrote with Irwin Levine this song, sung by a different Tony, whom you've worked with many times. In fact, you were doing backup singing on this recording as a studio member of Dawn.
Hands eat up. Just take my hand and I'll lead you. I promise life will be sweeter.
And it says so in my dreams.
Yep, that was Tony Orlando's
right.
Breakthrough record with Dawn.
The big secret at the time the record came out was, oh, that's Tony Orlando on it.
Everybody that knows that great voice knew it was Tony Orlando.
Who was Dawn on that record?
We really didn't have Dawn yet. Dawn in the studio on Candida, myself and Jay Siegel. From the Tokens, you know.
Oh.
There was one other voice on Candida, Robin Grion. So that was me, Robin, and Jay. And on Knock Three Times, it was myself, Linda November, and Jay Siegel.
All right, we're going to talk about Bob Crew right now. And Ron, you've done sessions with Bob?
Yes, I worked with Bob. He was one of my idols. He was one of the greatest producers of all time. He created more pop music sounds than anybody else I could think of. And when I got into the business, I was so impressed that I got calls from Bob Crew to do background singing for him. He had a very strange way of working, though. He would work late at night.
Oh.
So I could get a call at 10 o'clock, and he'd say, bring over two singers to the RCA studio, wherever he was working, and we're going to record until about 4 in the morning. And sure enough, I'd call a couple of singers and we'd go over there and we'd record. He was into numerology, so he said 2 a.m. is probably the magic time to make records. So we would be half asleep, but we'd be singing for Bob Crew. And he was a very generous man and a very cool guy, I must say.
Tony, did you do sessions with Bob?
I did, just like Ronnie. Ronnie and I started very young. We were writers for Donnie Kirshner. And through that office, Screen Gems Alden Music Office, we wound up doing demos. And from demos, we would wind up singing background, oohs and ahs on other people's songs. So as Ronnie, I wound up doing oohs and ahs on records and commercials and sessions. And yes, I did sessions for Bob. Do you remember Monty Rock?
Discotheques. Get dancing.
I was a sexolette, I will have you know.
Yes,
I was. In fact,
oh,
I saw Monty last week in Vegas. Every time we see each other, we just die laughing.
I actually got to talk to a sexolette. This makes my day.
A true sexolette.
All I can say is, wow. Ron, any closing thoughts about Bob?
He was a total gentleman and a perfect guy to work with as a musician. He got the most out of everybody in the session, from the bass player to the string player to the singers, of course. I mean, he did it all from the inception of the song right through the mix. I remember him as being one of the most fun guys to make a session with. And 100 years from now, those records will be played, and whatever medium is playing, you will hear Bob Crew music.
Tony?
Yes, again, he was a total gentleman. He was a very lovely man, an incredibly gifted man, and he's in my handful of top producers on that totem pole. He was a visionary. All of his thoughts were always right. He was unique in so many of them, and you would say, what is he thinking? But he was always right, and he made great, great records.
And now, a word from our sponsor. I believe I have on the phone a fabulous backup singer and quite possibly the most prolific jingle singer in history, Linda November.
Sir?
Are you meow, 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 meow?
That would be me, the Empress Jingle Queen.
How many jingles have you done?
22,000.
22,000.
Yes, and I'm terribly exhausted now.
I hope you're not too exhausted to talk with me for just a few more
never,
minutes.
Never, never, you are a darling. No, Ronnie, never.
You. Oh, you're saying all the right things.
I know.
I love it. Where do I make the check to?
I'll tell you later.
Indisputably, the two most famous commercials that you were involved with were Meow Mix and...
Meow Mix and Mean Joe Green. It's when the kid is in the locker room and Mean Joe Green is coming off the field and he's miserable. Mm-hmm. And the kid said, here, Joe, take my Coke. And he doesn't want to. But he finally does and we sing, a Coke and a smile. And then he throws him his towel. You know the spot?
Why, of course.
Want my Coke? It's okay. You can have it.
No, no.
Really, you can have it.
Okay.
Coke and a smile makes me feel good, makes me feel nice
year round.
It's you.
Have a Coke and thanks, Mean Joe.
Smile. It's been on the Super Bowl commercials. We won for 7 years in a row as best commercial.
Now we're going to talk about the man who this tribute is all about. When did you first meet Bob Crewe?
I got a call to do a Frankie Valli session, and it was 1967, and Artie Schreck and Charlie Colella were the arrangers, and they called me to sing the High Obligato, which I was infamous for, and a song called Donnybrook. And that's where they all heard me, and that's when my career was basically born. Bob was there. Everybody was there. And so then I got a call from Bob a little while later saying to me, I would like you to contract the singers for me on all my dates.
They could include you as part of the one.
Oh, of
contract.
Course, yeah. He wanted my brilliance, which is, you know, humility is my greatest quality, of course. He was into heavy numerology.
Really?
And the man that basically, I think, invented it or made it a science that became viable to the world, his name was Kevin Quinn Avery. I had him read my chart years ago, and he was right on. Every morning, he would come to Bob's beautiful penthouse about 6 o'clock in the morning and look at his chart and tell him what number it was that day. And whatever the number was, that's what he had to have. And this one morning, he called me, you know, God knows, we did so many sessions. He had asked me to hire 8 girls. Now, you want the best. You've got Linda November. You've got Valerie Simpson of Ashford and Simpson.
Right.
You've got Tony Wine. You've got Leslie Miller. You've got Petty Austin. Then you kind of have to go south a little and not get the greatest singers, but you've got 5 powerhouses. So the 5 of us are going to blow everybody out of the room, and the rest, you know, they sing in tune. We put them on the lower part, so it didn't matter. Because, I mean, when you have the 5 girls in the same session, it's magic, you know. So he calls me, darling, it's a 9-day. I said, what? It's a 9-day. I cannot go into the studio with 8 girls. You have to get me a 9.
How many people would know the difference between 9 and 8?
Nobody would know the difference. You could use 4 of us and double it and triple it. But he physically, because of his chart, had to have 9 bodies.
It was a numerology thing.
Bingo. So I said to him, Bob, do you know who I got for this date? Because I am the Empress. These girls would not do record dates, nor would I. There's not a 9th girl to get. It isn't possible. And he says, we'll just pick a girl off the street. Tell her we'll give her $50 and put her in front of a microphone and we'll turn off her mic. And that's what we did. You want to talk about Meshuggah? That's him. Oh, God, it was hilarious.
You sang backup on Good Morning Starshine by Oliver, a.k.a. William Oliver Swofford. Bob Crewe did the song initially with Eddie Rambeau, and he used children initially. Then what he did was kept the drum track, and then I guess... Wait a minute.
I'm singing.
You're singing. Did you do that on purpose?
I have to call you back. I'm doing an interview with my dear friend Ronnie.
Can I use that?
Yes, of course you can. Oh. I'll call you back.
What we just heard, that is your ringtone?
That is my ringtone, yes, Meow Mix. And Artie's ringtone is da 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 da.
And Artie, by the way, is Artie Schreck, your husband, heard elsewhere on this tribute, and he did the arrangement of that song, Can't Take My Eyes Off You, Frankie Valli. Getting back to Eddie Rambeau, Bob Crewe kept the drum track, then re-recorded other instruments, and he brought in a singer named William Oliver Swafford. He named him
right.
Professor Oliver.
Yes.
Now, what was your involvement with the recording of Good Morning?
He asked me to get, I think we were four girls, and he said, I'm going to do the session, and it was a very big hit.
Good morning, Oliver. So happy to be my love and me as we sing our early morning singing song.
When you think of Bob Crewe, what do you remember most?
The most beautiful man I've ever seen. Like eye candy, he was so gorgeous. And that he was nuttier than four fruitcakes. And I mean that in the most loving and wonderful way.
That concludes part three of our tribute. Please stay tuned for part four.